Good morning. Morning, everybody. Welcome back for our fourth session of this joint CMAC and GPF meeting. So we're going to turn a little bit more technical this morning. We thought we'd sort of, when you're bright and early and you're all fresh, we'll tackle the difficult subject of financial instruments with the characteristics of equity. And Manuel has a proposal and he wants your input. So Manuel's going to give an explanation and then we're going to set you off on a bit of a case study.
Yeah, that's right. Thanks, Steve. So agenda paper 5 asks for your input for our financial instruments with characteristics of equity research projects. So similar to other sessions, as Steve mentioned, I'll just give a quick tee up, then we can have the breakout sessions and have a fuller discussion after the benefit of looking at those case studies that we've prepared for you. I won't go into too much detail about what's happened since we last spoke to this group. I think I last spoke to this group back in 2014 about liabilities and equity as part of our conceptual framework project. So that was a while ago. The short story is that the board scoped the issue out of that project, and we're now looking at both the conceptual challenges and some of the application issues of debt equity as part of this research project. So I'll just give you a brief update on where we've got to and where we're going. The main focus of the project is to explore improvements to our existing standard on liabilities and equity, which is IAS 32. The problems we need to address have been evident through many submissions to the Interpretations Committee that have remained unresolved. Many of these have remained unresolved because the committee has found it difficult to identify a clear and consistent principle for distinguishing liabilities and equity in IAS 32. And new products are always testing those requirements. So as financial innovation kind of continues to develop, they're always going to be testing those requirements. And there are also existing inconsistencies with our conceptual framework. And part of the objective, and not necessarily the focus, is to address some of those inconsistencies. So the plan for these improvements is threefold. What we're aiming to do is clarifying the underlying rationale of the distinction between liabilities and equity to make it more robust and principle-based. We're looking to improve the presentation and disclosure requirements for some of these instruments because we think that's a key tool that might help us address some of the issues. We also want to improve the consistency, clarity, and completeness of the requirements in IAS 32 to address some of the application problems that have arisen. Now, the board has made some progress on classification and presentation, and we will be discussing disclosure and some finer points about some of the more complex topics such as derivatives and compound instruments in future meetings. Over the past 6 months, the board has been focusing on an approach that we think will provide useful information through a combination of both classification and presentation on the balance sheet and the income statement. I would like to emphasize that the rationale for that approach has been driven by the existing requirements of IAS 32, but together with feedback that we have received from users and investors on previous consultations, that includes views received on the discussion paper for the conceptual framework, the predecessor project, and also our comment letters on the agenda consultation. So we're trying to take those views into account. We are conscious of introducing too much complexity through these additional sub-classifications on the balance sheet and P&L. One of the messages we received last time we were here was that we should aim for an approach that is simple. Unfortunately, different people had different views about what a simple approach would be that would provide useful information across a very large variety of different instruments with different sets of features. The new approach we are pursuing acknowledges that one size does not fit all, but to manage the complexity, What we're trying to do is build a framework for both classification and presentation that is based on a common set of features. And so based on your feedback and the existing requirements of IS 32, we've identified a number of features that we've been focusing on. The first one is whether the claim requires a transfer of cash economic resources at specified dates other than at liquidation. So this is the traditional feature that has been used to define a liability, from the beginning of time or whatever. And it's useful for assessing, an entity's liquidity, and everybody worries about liquidity these days. The second feature is a bit more subtle, and that's whether the claim is for an amount that does not depend on the entity's resources. So that means it doesn't depend on the entity's performance, and so that's intended to capture those claims that have a payoff that is not similar to an ordinary share. And so for instance, if you have a bond that requires the payment of a fixed amount regardless of the performance of the entity, the bond requires a fixed amount. The question is, how do we manage those situations where a claim has one of those features and not the other? And so a good example is a share that is redeemable at fair value. And so in that instance, so the entity has issued a share that the holder can sell back to the entity at any point in time for the fair value of that share to be paid in cash. Now, that instrument requires the entity to deliver cash other than that liquidation. However, the payoff is the same as an ordinary share. So from a valuation type of perspective, the amount of that claim would be the same as an ordinary share. And so the approach that the board has been considering would classify such an instrument as a liability because it has that feature that it requires the transfer of cash, but present it separately on the balance sheet, and more importantly, present separately the changes in the value of that instrument. It's measured at fair value. Present that separately in the income statement, and one possibility is to present it in other comprehensive income. Again, this treatment was suggested by some CMAC members at the last meeting in 2014. I know there's been some changes in the CMAC over that time, but it'll be interesting to see whether what we've proposed has met those requirements. Furthermore, because under this approach, and one of the other messages that we've been receiving from investors for a very long time, is that you would like information about all claims other than the most residual claim against the entity, so ordinary shares. The approach that we're considering would classify more than ordinary shares as equity. However, what we're trying to do is provide more information about classes of equity other than ordinary shares through presentation. And so the proposal is, and this isn't illustrated in the case studies because the case studies focus more on classification and presentation of liabilities and equity, but the approach the board is pursuing would present claims other than ordinary shares that are classified as equity, would attribute some amounts of the net assets to those claims. And to limit the costs of doing this, the board is leveraging some of the existing principles in IS 33, which is our earnings per share disclosure requirement. For instance, when you're calculating earnings per share, you need to attribute some amounts to preference shares and to do some calculations for dilutive instruments such as options. And what the board's looking at is trying to see whether we can use some of those principles to make the distribution of returns, the waterfall of returns amongst equity claims, a bit more transparent in the financial statements through presentation. The upshot of this approach is that information will be provided about all claims against the entity. And so investors that have advocated for an approach that would classify only ordinary shares as equity should get the same information. There will be other claims classified, as I mentioned, there will be other claims classified as equity. The question is whether the classification as liabilities or equity, coupled with the presentation requirements that we're proposing, whether that will provide you useful information. The main effect of the classification is going to be on the totals in the balance sheet and P&L. And so that effect is still going to be there. And so we'd expect that, for instance, that classifying some of these instruments as liabilities and equity will change some of those subtotals. And what we'd like, so the question is whether that classification and presentation will provide useful information. And the second order question is whether how you will use that separate presentation to make assessments of the entity's financial position and its financial performance, and whether that separate presentation helps you make those assessments. I'll just stop there briefly just to take questions, clarification questions, before I get into what we're asking in particular on the case studies. Did anybody have any questions? Yes?
Gore first.
Oh, yes. Okay, I just want to clarify this product of redeemable shares at fair value. Is this just an illustrative purpose, or is there any real-life example? Because I just don't see any reason or economic rationale for any company to issue this kind of product.
It's a good question, and you know, it's a simplified example. I've simplified the instruments. For instance, you could substitute shares that are redeemable in non-controlling interests. That is the real problem that we need to address. It's the put options written on non-controlling interests, which have a similar type of feature. It is in the subsidiary. I've taken that complication away and have just said, think of it as an ordinary share that can be put back at fair value. And that's just a simplifying assumption, but the real problem is the NCI puts in the subsidiaries.
Okay, thank you. I just asked the profile of this product is exactly the same as common shares, which means that the cost of capital should be as high as equity. But at the same time, this product have a kind of liquidity risk to the issuers.
Yes.
So there is no reason for the company to issue this kind of product.
There's liquidity reasons. A lot of the reasons why, for instance, the NCI puts are issued is to create a market for those shares, because otherwise there would not be a market for those shares. And so these products exist primarily for liquidity reasons.
And let's not forget Fronterra in New Zealand, which brought about this whole debt equity exemption that we have in IS 32 today, because that's where this issue hits as well.
Yes, thanks, Frank. These instruments do exist. These are real problems. It's not just a hypothetical exercise we're going through.
A question on the rationale and the interpretation of independent of company performance. I'm just trying to understand, you know, what that means in practice and where it's coming from, because I would assume that there are a lot of instruments that are basically independent of company performance so long as company performance is within a relatively normal range, but under extreme disaster scenarios, they're suddenly no longer redeemable. And it's definitely with the put options, it has created problems where companies have actually had to restate contracts to basically get rid of this legal get-out clause that they don't need to accept a claim in bankruptcy situations. So I'm just trying to understand, you know, why, how we can get around that in practice, or what, how that's getting applied.
I think for both of, we need to do a bit more work on the finer details, and for instance, how they might apply to more complex instruments. And for instance, in that case, that would be more, if you just look at that feature, that might be a bit of a compound instrument which has a component which does depend and one that doesn't. And we still need to do a bit of work on how we might address those types of instruments. But I think just the main I guess, thing that I would like to take away from this discussion is whether that feature itself is of interest to users, because, for instance, a lot of comment letters from Craft, Humidian, etc., suggested that equity should only be those instruments that participate in the upside, and so they have the same payoff as, for instance, ordinary shares. So what I'd like to understand is whether we're capturing a similar type of feature, and that feature is of interest. And of course, we're going to have some complications and difficult scenarios. I mean, all of these instruments aren't as simple in real life as the ones that we've provided in the case studies. But I think the key thing is whether that feature is important to you as a user, and understanding how that might impact the distribution of returns, perhaps in different scenarios. And again, we haven't discussed disclosure yet. And so disclosure might also be an opportunity for us to deal with that as well.
Olivia?
Yes, I'm not sure to have understood how we'll be treated if you issue convertible bonds. Today you have the optional part, which is in equity, and the rest is in debt. Does this paper provide permission to classify all in one part, or will it remain the same?
I think we haven't discussed compounds in this paper. I don't think, for instance, for a convertible bond, that would have a feature that would potentially require cash going out, but it also has that flaw that requires the entity to pay a fixed amount, and only above that is there some equity kind of kicker, and that's a bit of a like an equity option. And we didn't include warrants and options, for instance, in this paper, but they would have the same payoff, and so they would be, if there wasn't any cash outflow requirement, then they would also be classified as equity. But as I mentioned, we would still want to provide a bit more information about those and how they might affect the distribution of returns.
The problem is you don't know if you are going to pay cash or if you are going to pay shares, give shares.
Well, there's a component of both then. Yeah.
You don't know what the person is going to ask.
Yes, yeah, you don't know. And so there's a component of both. And if the investor requires the cash outflow, then you have no other option but to pay that cash. So there's a component of both in that. Yeah. Okay.
The
instruments we're looking at today aren't compounds, and I think I've tried to make it as clear as possible that they're not compound instruments.
Manuel also, in this project, we have, I think, had a discussion on directly on point, but we have not talked about revisiting the current requirements to split compound instrument.
Let's not get into the compounds or the warrants or options or derivatives, because while the project will cover all of these things, today we're focused on these instruments, which are not compounds, not derivatives. Let's try and keep it away from those other things.
My point for my reason for making that point was to say, don't walk away from here with the thought that everything is up in the air. We're trying to focus on these issues.
Kevin?
Probably multiple questions. We already have transactions with owners. Is that now on the table to be withdrawn? Because that would potentially be some of your redeemable shares. Are you moving to a control model so that if the entity, if it's puttable by the holder, then I can see a potential liability? But if it's callable only by the issue.
Frank, have you got your mute off?
I bet it's Jan trying to get the other room set up.
But if it's totally in the hands of the issuer, then that doesn't seem like the same type of instrument. Because in your talking about your redeemable shares, I sort of get to a position that if I'm entering into a tender for a share buyback, I'm suddenly into estimating what my liabilities are, but for me it's a transaction with owners and I don't see a liability.
So I think, especially for instruments with call options, we haven't yet discussed that at what point that might give rise to a liability, because, for instance, some people think economic compulsion should be part of that assessment, and if the entity is economically compelled to repurchase that instrument, then it might give rise to a liability. We haven't yet jumped over that hurdle yet, but we are going to think about, for instance, what to do when the entity itself has the option to repurchase instruments, so it has a call option.
And if you can also add into the agenda subsequent changes, like, you know, in South Africa, I cannot issue a compulsory convertible bond as equity under the accounting rules, because I need shareholder approval to issue the equity. So I never had that at inception. I get it 21 days later.
Yep.
So the concept of having a liability for 15 years, when after 21 days I know it's equity, just anachronistic.
There are some we need to do some clean up of some of the existing requirements, especially around, for instance, around reclassification and things like that, which might potentially help that. But I don't want this discussion to start to cover. There is a broad range of different circumstances and scenarios and instruments.
The inception rule is so rigid that it does give wonky answers.
Malcolm?
Can I just ask?
Go ahead, Frank. Go on.
Yeah, can I just ask on paragraph 11, I guess, in that paper, where you talk about an obligation that's dependent on a specified amount, and then you talk about capturing claims, but your example of cumulative prefs are not obligations until we get into liquidation. So why do you use cumulative prefs as an example of an obligation when preparing accounts on a going concern basis?
Sorry, well, the cumulative prefs are a claim against the entity. And so we're trying to work out which claims against the entity should be classified as liabilities and which should be classified as equity. The feature of the cumulative pref that we're looking at is that it's for a fixed amount. Regardless of how the company performs, it will always be for a fixed amount. That accumulates over time. And even though the entity can defer payments of that amount until, for instance, liquidation, that set amount is going to go out before, for instance, any payments to other claims against the entity. I think that's the feature that we're focused on.
And that's actually the point I was wanting to raise, and I have to show my ignorance. I mean, first of all, this case study seems to be focused on classification and presentation and not measurement within equity. I have to say, until I looked at this example, I was expecting to see that once the company decided not to pay the preferential dividends, that actually would change the value in equity. But apparently,
well, maybe we should defer this till after we've gone through the case study, and this
okay.
will be part of
but
the discussion.
Should we talk about? I mean, going back to, I think, one of the drafts of the conceptual framework, there was a proposal to fair value certain elements of equity.
But this case study isn't about equity. It's two instruments which we're proposing to classify as liabilities.
So it's more about that rather than the issue about whether or not equity should be fair value.
Yeah, there are other issues in this project. We decided not to bring everything in one go, but to try and keep it focused. Mitch.
That probably addresses my question, which is that this case study addresses two equity instruments with bond-like features. But my question is, what about, in the context of these two case studies, should we also think more broadly about bonds with equity-like features, for example, deferrable coupons?
Yes, all of those are part of the project.
I mean, so cumulative, yeah.
Include those in their statements. You know, Telefonica includes
the yeah,
potential
yeah.
bonds in the statement.
Of equity.
Yeah.
And so cumulative pref shares, you can substitute, for instance, some bond that has a provision that they can defer payment at the issuer's request, you know, indefinitely, for instance.
Yeah.
So you can substitute that instrument. I mean, the feature that we're focused on is quite similar to that.
Thank you.
Right, everybody
clear. So the questions are on page 9. Manual has a straw man for how we're going to do this. Questions on page 9. The examples are the same for each of the two case studies. The two case studies are different in terms of the characteristics of the company. Does that influence your view about these two things? Do you support the idea that both of these things are liabilities and the presentation stuff that goes with it? We're trying to keep it focused on the case study itself, try and keep it focused on the two examples, two instruments that are in here. I'm sure when we come back together, the discussion will widen and we'll have other things being brought up, but let's try and keep it focused on these two things. And do you support the proposal, which is on page 9?
Yeah. And so two of the breakout sessions will focus on one case study. And so the Victoria room and the boardroom breakout sessions I would like to focus on the utility company, and the Canon room and the St. Paul's room breakout sessions, if they could focus on the pharma company. I know there's lots of farmers around here, but you can substitute a high-tech company if you want to make it interesting.
But the instruments are the same, aren't they?
The instruments are the same.
So don't feel you're losing out by looking at one or the other.
What time do you want us back here?
Right, so we're going to break now, and we're back at 10 past?
10 past 10?
Make it 10:15, as we're 5 minutes late. 10:15.
Right, off we go. Time bound and priority.
Let's go with the